Hey, Kent.
Hey, what's up? I was going to call you Chantastic.
You can.
But hi, Michael. Hi, Chantastic. You're fantastic, Chantastic.
Oh, thanks, Kent. So we're talking about open source, and you have had just a really prolific career in open source. And I want to talk about like how it's been good for you, but then also how maybe it's been not so great or been too demanding or emotionally exhausting or all of the kind of things, because I know that everyone wants to put this thing in the world that like the world loves, but then doesn't not everyone kind of sees the work and the heartache and the pain that goes into that. So I thought that'd be a fun thing to talk about. But to open up, why don't you tell me how your open source journey started?
Yeah, my first pull request was fixing Java doc in the Play framework. It's a Java backend framework. And I just noticed a typo. I think it was the word value. They missed the A, so I fixed that. Made it my first ever pull request. They made me sign this thing called the CLA, Contributor License Agreement. And I was like, all right, I guess. And if that's what it takes to get this typo fixed. Yeah, and then they merged that in. And that was my first ever pull request on GitHub. I think it was my first real exposure to GitHub. And then, or actually, no, I had been doing like putting up some stuff on GitHub. Like for me, before I really got into Git and GitHub, I was using Dropbox to host all of my stuff. And that worked out pretty well, you know, with the multiple computers I was using and stuff. And I was able to like revert sort of because they had like history. But if I had like a big thing that I'd done, there was like no chance in heaven that I would be able to figure out how to get that stuff back. So switching over to Git, GitHub just became the default place where I just put stuff.
Okay.
And so like the little, like at school, I would build little projects or like tiny libraries that I would use in multiple projects. And so I'd put them all on GitHub. And I didn't ever really expect people to use it, but I still documented them like sort of okay-ish. Just like, this is what this thing is and here's how you use it. So like, if you look back at my old GitHub profile, you'll see some Java libraries and stuff, just with a bunch of utility methods. And then eventually I did make that first pull request, and that was still a Java thing. And then it was a while before I started getting more serious into doing open source contributing and like maintaining of projects that people actually use.
What did it feel like to have that first pull request merged? Because I know that there can be like a big gap when you're like starting your career, feeling like, okay, there's me, and then there's everyone else who knows what they're doing, understands how open source works, and like does, you know, like just really high quality work. So what did it feel like to like kind of have that first like thing accepted into a, you know, a big project?
Well, I know that a lot of people feel really nervous about getting involved in open source. That was not my experience. I had I guess there's a level of hubris or just confidence in myself. And like, maybe I didn't know enough to know that like I was out of my league. I don't know. It just didn't register to me as something stress inducing or anything.
Sure.
It was just like, yeah, like I'm fixing a typo, big whoop. And I was never really super nervous about it. And I was at a company contributing code to that company a lot. So for me, when it was first merged, it was like, hey, sweet. Like this is my first ever pull request that like a framework is using. And the Play framework is not a small thing. Like there are a lot of,
it's a big framework.
It's a big framework. So like, yeah, that was pretty cool. But it was a typo, you know.
Sure.
I didn't feel like a huge sense of accomplishment. And now looking back, being exposed to the number of people that I've helped get into open source, it actually is kind of a big deal for a lot of people to get that first pull request in. And so I have a renewed appreciation for the maintainers who like they had a bot that asked me, or no, I think they asked me explicitly like themselves to sign the CLA and like they spent, I don't know, maybe 5 minutes of their lives dedicated to helping me get a typo fixed in Java doc.
Yeah.
And so now, like at the time, I was just like, you know, shrugged it off. But now as a maintainer of bigger projects, I know that it's like, that doesn't come for free because you have hundreds of contributions like that every week or every month in a big framework like that. And yeah, it takes some time. And so I really do appreciate that they spent that time helping me do that.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, I know that a big part of open source is community, and it's making people feel welcome for all contributions. And I know that this has been kind of a big thing for you. You've had all contributors where you try to make sure that anyone who makes a pull request, actually lands a commit, is recognized in the documentation. I'm kind of curious, where does that come from? Like, obviously, I don't think this is something that was maybe publicized as big, like on the README before you had started, you know, building this tool. Where did that like desire kind of come from to make sure that everyone had, you know, their face on that README?
I stand on the shoulders of giants every day. Like, there are so many things that I know and that I teach people or that I encode in my libraries or whatever that are not, like, I wouldn't have been able to figure that out myself. And so I have this, like, I'm not perfect at it. I don't always give credit where it's due or like, I mean, I try to, but I don't always succeed. But I really think that it's important that we do that.
Yeah.
That we do try our hardest to say, you know, these aren't my original ideas. This is where this idea came from. And so, like, that's just kind of how I feel about things generally, more than just code. It's just everything. Credit the work of others. And so, yeah, there are a couple of thoughts that I have with this. So that's one side of things that's motivated this all contributors thing, which for the uninitiated, all contributors is a specification that I created for basically a table of all the people who've contributed to the project. And like your first thought to that is like, well, yeah, we have the like GitHub shows you all the people who've committed code, but there are other people who contribute in different ways. And like there are people who help a lot on the like community sites answering questions and stuff like that. That's not going to show up in any graph like that. So that's why I created this all contributor. And it's also really cool to see your face on the README. Like, sure. Who doesn't want that?
Totally.
So that's what all
people pay or companies pay like thousands of dollars to have like their logo on a README. So yeah, it feels pretty good like at all levels.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So that's what all contributors is. And so there's the one half where I just feel really motivated to make sure people are credited for the work that they do. And then the other side of it is years ago, I was maintaining a library called Angular Formly. It was a library that was written by somebody else. I started using it really heavily and then they handed it off to me because they weren't using it anymore. And I maintained it. And it probably is still the number one forms library for AngularJS. It got to be pretty big in that community. And there was a time, and we could probably dive a little deeper into this, but there was a time in my life where I spent way too much time doing open source. and like my wife and I had a little friction at some points because I just like spent too much time doing open source. And so it was pretty common for somebody to open a bug on that project or any of my projects. And I would have it fixed before they checked their email again to see if I'd responded. Like, I remember one time in particular, they filed an issue. I said, I know exactly what this is. I'll have a fix published in 5 minutes. And it was like, it just boom, and I'm done. And like, I had the releases automated and tests and everything. Like, I knew exactly what it was. It was like 2 or 3 line change. It was really easy. And like, you know, they're given accolades. They're like, oh, this is an amazing project. Thank you for being such an amazing maintainer. And, you know, my head is growing at the whole time. Like, and so there was one time when somebody said, hey, there's this problem. And I said, oh, I know exactly what it is. I'll have this done really quick. And I wrote, like, when you've got a library and you're fixing a bug, pretty much every time I have that situation, I will write the test first to reproduce the bug. Sure. Like, so that is like the quintessential TDD situation for me. It's like, I've got a bug. Let me write a test to reproduce it to make sure I fix that. And so I'd written the test. And then the change was like basically a single line. I just needed to change something, like something on a single line. So I changed that single line, the test passed, and I was like, sweet. And right before I committed it, I was like, you know, that was so easy for me. I bet it would be like mean a lot for somebody to do this instead of me. Like, what if I just had somebody else do this? And so I stopped right where I was. I actually committed the test. Of course, it was failing, so I skipped it. I did like the it.skip or whatever. And so I committed the test, but not the finished version. And then in the issue, I like wrote out step-by-step guide of what you would need to do to to fix this. So like turn the test back on. Here's exactly the line that you need to change and here's how you need to change it. Like it was extremely hand-holdy because my goal wasn't to, you know, have somebody struggle to figure out how to solve the problem. My goal was to get somebody to contribute to open source for the first time. And so I don't need them to have extra hurdles in the process because there are plenty of hurdles as it is. So I make this issue super straightforward. And then at the end, I said, I will only accept a contribution for this from somebody who's never contributed to open source before. And then I tweeted that out and it got a lot of attention. Somebody, you know, volunteered first. I said, you know, whoever comments first is the one who gets it. I figured that this would be a pretty popular thing like people would want to do. Yeah. So somebody volunteered. It wasn't very long, but it was certainly longer than had I just pushed it myself. So like it was an investment myself, but like that, the person who contributed that and made that fix became a contributor to the project and did more stuff. So it was an investment in that person. And I did that a number of other times in the project. And I called this first timers only. And I made an issue for that. Somebody made a Twitter bot that will tweet every time a GitHub issue gets a label first timers only added to it. Scott Hanselman and I collaborated on firsttimersonly.com, which is like gives some resources on how to contribute to open source. So it became this big thing. And then I made a how to contribute to open source thing on Egghead that I point a lot of people to. And there was a repo there. It was just like a practice repo. So it was called Stack Overflow Copy Paste, where you'd go to a Stack Overflow thing and copy paste a utility function and add it to this module. And it was actually nice. Published like it's a real thing. It worked out really nice. I helped 100 people make their first pull request on that repo. So like there's always been like since that first time where I decided, hey, I'm going to let somebody else do this one because it was so easy for me. Let's let somebody else try. I have like totally shifted the way that I view open source as a much more collaborative thing where I'm willing to put in extra work so that I can give other people opportunities. And ultimately, it ends up being better for everybody because then I can move on from a project and I know other people have worked in the project and they can keep it going. So yeah, there's a bunch of stuff in there.
Yeah, a lot of stuff.
That's some of the things that motivate me around open source and helping people.
I feel like that kind of that story kind of covers like the entire arc of the topics that we were hoping to cover today. So I feel like maybe we should just like back up to the first part of that, which is that tension of overcommitting to open source, or maybe even like if open source addiction, if you will, because it's definitely a thing. And I kind of want to talk about, I guess, what is it that you think that is, right? Like, is it a desire to like just look smart, like kind of inflate your ego? Is it a desire to maybe do things a way that you've seen them not done well? Like, oh, I've opened issues for 10 open source projects. No one said anything. And, you know, I want to be the person who can fix it in 5 minutes. What are some of those feelings that go into that initial stage of an open source project where you got the issues, but now it's kind of like running your life?
Yeah. Oh, man. Well, for me, it's not ever been about maintaining a project better than someone else. I will admit that if I have created a project, I'll just give a specific example. I sometimes go over to the Enzyme issues. And Enzyme, for those who don't know, is a testing library for React that predates React testing library, which I created. And I didn't like it, the way Enzyme did stuff. And there was no way I could like get my ideas into Enzyme. So I made my own thing. So yes, I will sometimes go over to Enzyme's repo and I'll look that they have hundreds of issues and pull requests and stuff. And just kind of smile at my own, like, you know, 6 or 7. So there's a little bit of competition and like feeling there. And I realize that's not entirely healthy. Yeah, probably shouldn't do that. But for the most part, it's like the addiction that I had have had to open source wasn't really driven by wanting to be the best maintainer. It was more like, honestly, it's a little hard to describe, but when you create something that has like, let's say you spend 2 hours trying to solve this problem and you spent that 2 hours and you ship it off to the world, assuming that it would take every engineer who uses it the same amount of time to solve that problem for themselves if it weren't for your thing, then like you have 2,000 people or 10,000 people using your stuff, you saved 20,000 hours. And like, there's a high with that, man. Like,
oh, yeah.
You just, I feel like the king of the world when I think about the number of hours and time that I've saved people. And really, like, I'm motivated to make the world a better place. And the more time that I can save people on useless stuff, the like, you know, what testing library to use or how to write tests effectively and get confidence in their code base, the more time I'm able to save people doing that, the more they're able to pursue whatever it is they're doing to make the world a better place. So like, there is just something about that that makes me like really, really motivated to work on this. And then on top of that, there's just the challenge of programming. So there was one night in particular, I was working on this library called API Check, which is basically like React prop types as a separate module before they made prop types a separate module.
Okay.
So I actually opened an issue on React and I was like, hey, could you make the prop types thing a separate thing? And they're like, no. And so I made API Check because I was using API Check for Angular formally to do some runtime checking of like your configurations and stuff like that. It was really cool. But I remember it was like, I don't know, 10 in the evening. The kids had gone to bed. My wife was hanging out by herself. She kind of likes that anyway, to spend some time alone after she's been like, kids are talking to her all day. And so I'm just chilling, working on stuff with API Check. And I was in flow and I was just like super excited about working on this thing. And that's another cool thing about open source is you don't have a product manager.
Yeah.
So you get to decide, like, it's totally up to you. You get to take this any direction that you want. You get to spend the time doing whatever you want to do and making this project the thing that you want to use.
I think about it like, what was that movie? The one where you go into the subconscious. What was that movie? They had the...
Oh, Matrix Inception?
Inception. Yeah, yeah. That's the one. And I just remember like they were like constructing these worlds and like tearing them down. Like there's a scene where they're like actually like building it. And it's not just like, you know, like Lego stuff, but you're actually like kind of like seeing these worlds be built and then you're like destroying the parts that don't work anymore. And it's like when you're in that zone, it's like so fun. Like there's a real high that comes with having that full control over this entire world of like a new open source project.
Yeah. Yeah. It's totally like euphoric and like, you're just, it's really exciting. Yeah. I love it. I love it so much. And when it's something that you've decided you want to do and you're like into, like you can get into flow in work projects and stuff. Sure. Like I'm making this drop down and it's like super exciting, you know, like I've gotten there, but it's easier to do that when you're working on your own thing. You're going to be the one consuming this API and like, wow, this is a great idea. Let me try this. And that was a bad idea. Like you're just into it. And so it's 10 PM. And then like, it starts getting a little bit later. And my wife starts asking, you know, texting me like, hey, are you almost done? And you know, what do you say when you're a programmer? Yeah, of course. I'm almost done.
A few minutes away. Like, no big deal.
Yeah, totally. And then like new ideas pop in your head or like the thing you tried didn't work out. Or like my personal favorite, you have to push it to CI and then doesn't work and you don't know why. And so you have to like muck around with configuration again and push it up again and wait like 10 minutes every time. Stuff like that happens. And this night in particular, it was not CI or anything. It was just like I was in and I just kept having ideas. And I was like, oh, now I want to add like the dot is required, you know, field, or I want to do all these different, you know, like fancy programming things. And it was just so fun. And I kept on telling her that I was almost done until at like 2 a.m, she comes downstairs and she's like, so are you coming? Or like, and she was not happy with me. And like, in retrospect, I should have just said, hey, I'm like super in it right now. I'm not gonna come to bed. Is that okay? Like you just go to bed by yourself if that's all right. This was like relatively earlier in our marriage. And so we didn't like going to bed at different times and stuff. So yeah, I think we both would have done a lot better now, having been married for 9 years now. But at the time, that was when I realized that, hey, maybe this open source like thing that I've got is encroaching on areas of my life where it shouldn't.
Interesting.
And I should take a step back. And Like, no, literally nobody was asking for the features I was building. It was just something I was into. And you know, like, I built cool features and they were useful. People used them when I was done. But, like, honestly, who cares, right? Like, nobody's asking for it today. And even if they are, that person has no right to come between you and your spouse or whatever other relationships you've got and your own personal health. Like, I mean, staying up till 2 a.m. working when you're in flow, like, that's fun. Like, go, sure. Go for it.
It's a party night. That's like your weekend.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm sure it impacted my day. The next day I was like tired and probably not very nice and stuff. So, like, take care of yourself. Don't do that often and just be aware that you're not going to be super pleasant the next day. But yeah, that was when I started to realize that, first of all, like, I need to not do that. Like, string my wife along and tell her I'm almost done when I'm not. But then also, like, when you work on an open source project that people are actively using, they can just naturally, and especially when you've given them the impression that you will respond to their requests, they naturally fall into this idea that you'll continue to do so. Mm. And, like, it really is a sense of entitlement. And I don't necessarily mean that in a bad way, because I mean, entitlement's not great. And some people are total jerks and really expect you to do stuff for free. But, like, I created for myself this impression for others that I will just do stuff for them for free.
Sure.
And I will sacrifice my family relationships and whatever else to solve their problems. And so over the last few years, I've developed this change of attitude where now I'm like, your problem's not my problem. I will enable you to solve your problem because I'm on GitHub and you can make pull requests and I'll review those when I have time. But I am not going to solve your problems for you anymore. Like, so now the only problems that I solve, the only issues that I address are issues that I run into that I, like, I personally am experiencing. Or sometimes I will also work on stuff when I think it'll just be a fun time and I've got the time to do it. But yeah, that was a big change for me around that time where I just said, you know what? I'm only working on stuff that I need done. And I, like, before it was like, I'm working on all of this stuff so that my thing can be the thing. Like, everybody will use this thing and it's going to be so awesome. Now it's like, if my thing solves your problem, that's awesome. If it doesn't, you can contribute and make it solve your problem. That's great. But I'm not doing work for free for you.
Yeah. Well, this is really interesting because it sounds like in your experience, what happened was you modeled that in your own creation of open source, right? Like, you would go to the project, say like, hey, I really need this feature. Can we do it? And they would say, actually, that's not on our roadmap. And then you went off and made your own thing. And so I imagine that it's kind of additionally frustrating when someone comes into your project, like after you've done that, you've kind of like, you know, forked it, if you will. And they come in and they're like, this has to do this thing. And like kind of all, you know, pissy about like what it does or doesn't do.
Yeah.
And then kind of doesn't either like contribute or like kind of follow that forking trend of like, okay, cool. Well, this doesn't do that thing. I guess I'll just kind of fork the concept or fork the code or, you know, do whatever and kind of take it in a new direction. And it sounds like you've kind of, it took you maybe a little bit of time to get there, but to kind of expect in others what you expected from yourself, which is to solve your problem and kind of share in kind, hopefully.
Yeah, exactly. I think I, early on in my open source life, I saw every new issue of somebody saying like, I need this feature. I saw that as a business requirement from a customer.
Sure.
And when you get a customer business requirement, like, what do? You have to implement it or you drop the client. But like, I didn't want to drop any clients because I wanted all of the clients. and so
total domination found, or nothing.
That's right. Yeah. And so what I found was if I go around things with that attitude, then I add all the features. And there are so many problems with that. I have a talk called Managing Open Source Projects. And in it, I explain that like the more complexity that you add to your code base, the more documentation you have to worry about, the more API surface layer or area. Actually, I think I talked about this in my Simply React talk, where it's like these are different patterns you can implement to keep things simple. But I just found that the more stuff I added, the less useful it became, which is really interesting. So instead of adding more, maybe inverting control a little bit to expose the ability for people to do what they need to do. So make it more flexible, even though they maybe have to do a little bit of work, or just sometimes straight up saying no.
Yeah.
And so early on, it was like, okay, I'll just implement all the things. But then it just became really hard to maintain. Therefore, like, I never handed Angular formally off to anybody. That project, even though like I felt like I did an okay job of onboarding people onto it, it just never, it got so complicated that I could never find anybody to take that over. That repo is archived. People still use it. The website's still up. And I think I get like several thousand visitors a week or something on that website still. So it's, you know, very popular. AngularJS is not going away anytime soon. But yeah, nobody's maintaining that project at all. And so from that, I learned like, I really need to make sure that what I'm making is maintainable by more than just me, or by me in like 6 months. And like, I don't have to say yes to everybody's problems.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, like I can take that as not as business requirements from a customer, but as, you know, suggestions in the suggestion box that I can take or leave. And I used to also like make sure that I looked at every single issue that was ever filed against my repos. And I responded and I answered questions and everything. I don't do that anymore either. I'll glance at it. I still get emails, you know, for every single comment and whatever. And I'll glance at it really briefly. And if I see somebody say something wrong or do something wrong with the library, I will often just ignore it and I'll let somebody else deal with it, or they can figure it out on their own later. And it seems like really heartless, but it is a self-care mechanism. Yeah. So like my attitude toward open source has changed, but I feel like my impact on open source has been increased despite that, which is interesting.
Interesting. Now, you brought up some interesting stuff that I really want to talk about, because I think inversion of control, as you mentioned, is something that people struggle with a lot. And I don't necessarily want to talk about inversion of control, except for how it plays into open source.
Mm.
And it does feel like there's this tension a lot of times to have a thing that does everything, because that's what demos well, versus having something that does a small part of the thing, because that's going to be the most long lasting. You know, like think of, you know, a framework, you know, that is constantly having to like evolve and adapt and like has thousands of pull requests, you know, versus something mm-hmm. like Lodash, right? Where it's like there's these utility functions and it's kind of like, and in Lodash, you can just like pick what you want. You can pick one of them if like you just need to extend JavaScript in one way, mm-hmm. and how so much of that code is better suited to stand the test of time than these things that kind of solve the whole world. I'm kind of curious, like, how have your projects, I guess, modeled what you're calling like inversion of control and like letting people, like giving people the tools to solve their own problem versus solving it for them and then kind of trying to field the wave of issues that then become not their problem, but your problem now.
Right. Yeah. 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 That's the thing. Like, so we're talking about, or this is all part of Epic React. So a React example is very perfect here. And I think one of the best examples of inversion of control that I've implemented was in Downshift, this library that allows you to make enhanced inputs. So you type in it, it auto-completes, or there's a type ahead, or you can even use it for dropdowns or multi-selects and stuff like that. And Downshift differed from everything else in the fact that it did not render anything for you. So it didn't differ from, like, there were libraries that were headless, so-called before, but this was the first like enhanced input or autocomplete or select thing that implemented that idea. And it did so using render props. Now Downshift has hooks that I would recommend instead. That was just a form of inversion of control. But then like a great example of how I took that further is you'll notice that like these complex React components end up accepting like millions of props because, you know, like we're trying to cover every use case in the world. And I remember getting an issue from somebody who wanted to change some of the opinions that I'd taken inside of Downshift. So like for a library to be useful, it has to make opinions, like it has to do sure. something. Otherwise, it's not useful at all. Like you just do my own thing. And so I did make, you know, have some opinions on what happens when, like, should the mode or the dropdown open when the user clicks in there, or should it only open when they start typing, or should it close when they select an item? I think that was the specific issue. Like this user didn't want the dropdown to close when the user selected an item, probably because they were trying to build a multi-select. And so they wanted to add a prop that was like, you know, close on select or something like that, right? So they could disable that behavior. And that's not a hard thing to do, right? Like, you just stick wherever you've got that click handler, when the user clicks on an item, you just have if props dot, you know, close on select, then do this thing, otherwise do this other thing. Really easy for that to happen. But another thing that's really easy is for the next person to come and say, I want this change of behavior, and another person say, I want this change. And eventually you have use case specific props, which is something you never want to have. Just like this is a prop for this use case and this is a prop for this use case. And then you have a third use case that doesn't, like, nobody's asking for, which is the combination of those two props, right? And so now, like, it just explodes exponentially. And I'd done this before. I'd experienced this and I didn't want to experience it again with Downshift. And so I thought, how could I make it so that I can support their use case and literally every other use case if somebody wanted to customize the state? And so I thought, well, what if we just say, like, accept some sort of function and we say, hey, function, I'm about to make a state change. Here's what it was before. Here's what it is now. And here's why I'm making the change. Tell me what the change should be. So if you don't do anything, I'll just make this change. But if you want to, like, make some alteration to that, then I'll change it to whatever you want it to be. And that is, I think I initially called that prop modify state change. And then I decided instead on state reducer, because Redux, you know, was a big thing at the time, still is. And so I changed the arguments to be state and changes. And then changes would have a type prop that you could use to determine what is happening. Like, this is a, you know, clicking out of the dropdown, or this is clicking on an item or whatever it is. And then when I implemented that, then, like, the whole world opened up for people. They could totally customize anything about this sure. And in such a simple way. Like, it was so easy. Questions stopped happening. Like, people didn't have questions about how to customize stuff anymore, because, like, this was so straightforward. I found out later that reason components, like ReasonML, ReasonReact, those reason components actually have a reducer prop, like, just built into the framework. Every component has a reducer prop, I guess. That is basically this. It just allows you to control how state changes happen, which was validating to me. But that was the state reducer pattern. I still use that. I teach that in Epic React. And that inversion of control just gives people, like, that is how I was able to solve so many use cases with this open source library without making it more complex for everybody.
Yeah, I think the way you said it is something that I really love, and something that I guess in my own work have tried to communicate to people, where it's like, yes, like, this, if we do it the way that you're suggesting, it will solve it for you today, right? If we flip it on its head a little bit, like, if we take the opportunity to say, like, hey, this isn't just one problem, but it could be 1,000 problems. If we flip it, then we can solve every problem, like, now and for forever.
yeah, exactly.
And it's such an appealing thing, especially in open source, because then, you know, issues come in and it's like, oh, okay, well, I don't have to give you control of something that you already have control over. Like, you already own it. Like, just use it.
Yep. And that's one of the cool things about React too, is just the level of composition. And now that we have hooks, it's just like, the sky's the limit. You're just like, so you've got one monster hook that does all the things, and then somebody wants you to change some little thing. Break that thing into several other hooks, and then your monster hook now is just composing those things together. And you say, instead of using the monster hook, just use the parts of the little hooks that you want, you know. And you just expose the little hooks that build up this monster hook, and now that's, you have total control. So, and you have the same thing with components as well. Like, at PayPal, I had a base component and then a component on top of that for styling stuff, or for something else, and then a component on top of that for styling three different variants of this thing. And so you could build on top of any of those three layers for total customizability. And just the composition inversion of control gives your users a ton of power without sacrificing your time and your docs.
Well, this is all really good feedback for people who are looking to kind of make a dent in open source. We're getting close to the end of our time for this episode, but I want to close with, like, when do you let go of an open source project? Because these things can be so personal, and you've spent your nights and weekends and blood, sweat, and tears poured into these products. I'm curious, like, how have you kind of thought about emotionally letting go of these projects, handing them over, when not to hand them over, when to just like kind of shutter them or kind of leave them archived? Tell me a little bit about how you think about that for each project.
Yeah. So it is hard to like put so much effort into it and then decide to let it go or hand it off to someone else. I have several projects that were successfully handed off. And part of my attitude change has been, if somebody else is going to do it, then that's great because I can benefit from their work and I can go do some other cool thing. Sure. And so like at first it was like, oh, how sad. I don't want to leave this thing. But now I'm like, sweet, sick, take it, please. I have so many other things I want to do with my time. So it's not super hard for me now to hand things off. It was at the beginning, but as I've developed more and more things that I want to do or like come up with more and more ideas, like old projects that are already working for me and are pretty much just like in maintenance mode, I'm more than happy to hand those off. Sometimes you'll get somebody who will kind of rip off your project, or maybe they're not even being intentional about ripping it off. They just decided that it would be easier for them to build their own version of this thing. And that's the way open source works. Like,
sure.
Like nobody says you have to contribute to an existing project. And it's not like, it should not be offensive that somebody doesn't use your project. You know, like who cares, right? I'm writing code. So like I have had experiences. I wouldn't say that this was a ripoff at all. Like this was just, they had a different use case from what I built. But when I was at PayPal, I built this project called Glamorous. It was a CSS and JS project built on top of Glamour. And Glamorous was kind of based on styled components. So I guess you could say I sort of ripped off styled components in some ways, except I didn't like the template literals with CSS syntax. I really Sure. liked object syntax. And so that's why I built Glamorous. And there were a couple other differences too, and it was great. And I ran Glamorous for like a year or so, and it was going awesome. You know, we had some problems here and there, and we were working on them, trying to make things fast and whatever. And then Emotion came out. And Kai, who created Emotion, he had actually contributed to Glamorous quite a bit. And then he decided to kind of move, like, rip out Glamour underneath the hood. And actually, Sunil Pai, who wrote Glamour, kind of gave Kai some ideas and some had some experiments. And so Kai rewrote that whole engine underneath the hood and built his own thing called Emotion. And when I saw Emotion, I was like, wow, they're like, here's like solves so many of the problems that I have in Glamorous. I sure wish he'd like contributed those solutions to my project. That'd be nice. But you know, it would have been a lot of work to do that. So I guess, what do I do now? Like, I could get mad at Kai, but like, that'd be stupid. So I didn't. I was like, Kai, this is awesome. Great job. And then what do I do with Glamorous? Do I say like, we'll get to fixing those things that Kai has fixed in Emotion? Or do I just say, hey, thanks, Kai. Now I don't have to deal with Glamorous anymore. And that's what I did.
Hey, so, Glamorous users, here's your new library.
Yeah, exactly. And so actually somebody made a code mod for switching us over. Major, he made a code mod for automatically switching your Glamorous code to Emotion because they were pretty similar in the API. And so that was reasonably possible. And most projects were able to just migrate automatically in like an hour. And so, yeah, it worked out awesome. And now I don't do anything with CSS and JS libraries anymore. I use Emotion. I think it's awesome. And we actually use it in Epic React. And yeah, it works out great. I'm so glad that I don't have to do that anymore.
And it freed you up to become the testing guy.
Yeah, exactly. And I'm happier in that position, I think. So I see those, you know, letting it go. It's tough. And actually, so when I left the Angular community for the React community, I had these Angular projects, like several open source libraries. And I asked Ryan Florence, I was like, Ryan, what did you do when you left the Ember community? And it was just really simple for him. He was just like, if they're popular enough, then people will pick it up and they'll take it over. And if they're not, then they'll just die. And if they're not popular enough, then who cares, right? Like if people aren't don't care enough to take over the project and fix it themselves, then they don't care enough, right? So nobody cares. Like it doesn't matter. So that actually was really nice for me. And I like pretty much all my Angular projects, I don't think there's any of them that were taken over. None of them were, nobody stepped up, which was kind of interesting to me. But yeah, and it was okay. Everything was fine. So I just kind of, it ends up being okay.
Yeah, yeah. Well, now I know that, you know, so we've talked about letting things go or letting things die or handing them off. But I know I've heard you say, like, you know, people can pull React testing library from your cold dead fingers. So how do you decide what to keep?
Oh yeah. So React testing library is tricky. I honestly would love to hand that off to somebody else as the core, like the actual maintainer. That would be so nice. Save me so much time. The real problem is I am so invested in the correctness of React testing library. I really want to make sure that no decision is made that will take it in a wrong direction. And I know that James had this similar issue with Prettier when he was switching, like, you know, handing off Prettier. He's like, I can't do this anymore, but I really want to make sure the direction is correct. But I'm not exactly sure how he finally decided to hand it off. But I kind of am feeling like I'm in that spot right now where I'm like, I'd really like to hand it off to somebody else, but I really am struggling with the idea of giving my baby to somebody else and having them raised by a stranger, you know? So I imagine that eventually I won't be the core maintainer and the main maintainer of the core testing library. And I'm not the maintainer of all the testing library implementations either. I only maintain the DOM testing library, which is the one that most of them are built on top of, and Cypress testing library and React testing library. And I definitely foresee a future where I'm not maintaining all of those, and somebody else is. But it's just really difficult for me to say, okay, here you go. Please don't ruin it. and if I'm being honest too, like part of it is I have courses that are built around these frameworks too. And I want to make sure that changes are respectful of the people that I'm teaching so that like breaking changes aren't just made willy-nilly. And it's more than just the courses. It's also like the users. And maybe I should just trust because I'm not the only maintainer of these things either. And maybe I should just trust the other maintainers a little bit more. Yeah, I got to do a little more introspection there.
I think it's interesting. There's an interesting distinction there where React testing library, you've built the API around principles, right? Principles that you believe really strongly for testing. And it's really, really hard to share those principles, you know, completely with someone else. There's always some type of like degradation or, you know, like, you know, different opinions kind of like start to come in, and those can really affect in profound ways the outcome of that library and the way that it's used. And so I can definitely see why that would be a hard thing to let go of, because principles are just really hard to codify.
Yeah. And like if they misinterpret some principle or like a lot of it has to do with my level of experience in testing. And I know that if we add this API, it will cause people to write these kinds of tests, which are bad and go against our principles. But not everybody has the experience to see that adding that API will cause this effect. And so like Downshift, I was able to hand that off. That wasn't a huge thing. And especially since I wasn't really using it actively either anyway. Sure. But React testing library, that's something I'm using and I'm actively teaching. And so it's really hard for me to say, okay, I'm going to hand this off. Hopefully you don't make any mistakes in adding APIs that incurred poor tests or something. Yeah. So, I mean, we've got some maintainers who are like have better ideas around testing than even I do. And so I feel like we'd probably be in really good hands if I did decide to hand it off, but I don't think I'm quite ready.
Well, I'm sure you'll get to that point eventually. Kent, thanks so much for talking us through how you think about open source and all of your experience, your vast experiences there. You've had a lot of them in a very short period of time. I'm really excited to continue our conversations and talk about like how you keep it productive, building an audience, speaking in public, how to learn, all kinds of exciting stuff coming up real soon. Thanks, Kent.
Thank you.